Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Later on in this episode, producer Matt Fidler and I will give you our take on our Apollo at 50 series in light of the new Netflix film, Apollo 10 and a half. But first, the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California is truly one of the homes for the search for life beyond Earth. And its pioneer founder, a scientist who did some of the earliest experiments with radio telescopes to search for extraterrestrial intelligence, also known as SETI, was Frank Drake. Arguably the most prestigious prize in this fascinating field of astronomy is the Frank Drake Award, and in 2022, the winner is Dr. Shelley Wright, an astronomer at the University of California, San Diego. Shelley Wright has done groundbreaking work developing instruments to try and detect the signatures of alien civilizations using optical and near-infrared wavelengths instead of the more traditional search methods using radio. We'll talk to Shelley Wright about her work in just a bit, but our first guest is Lucianne Wolkowicz. Lucianne is an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago and joined us recently to talk about what makes Shelley Wright such a deserving recipient of the Frank Drake Award from the SETI Institute. Lucianne, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Hey, the first thing I want to ask you is, could you tell us a little bit about the Drake Award? Tell us about what the Frank Drake Award is and why you got involved in this.
Sure. The Drake Award is an award given out by the SETI Institute every year that recognizes exceptional individuals whose research has really contributed to advancing the field of SETI, or the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So I got involved because I am the chair of the SETI Institute's Science Advisory Board and have served previously as a member on the advisory board. And we have the wonderful task every year of looking at our colleagues who have contributed to the field and selecting a person or persons to honor with the Drake Award.
And of course, this year, the winner is Shelley Wright. And I'd like you to tell us a bit about why she got selected. What makes her so special?
Sure. So Dr. Wright's work is really kind of special in SETI. You know, a lot of times when people imagine SETI research, they have a picture in their mind, like Jodie Foster's character in Contact, of astronomers listening with these big radio dishes. And of course, radio has a very long history in SETI. It's kind of where the field started with Frank Drake's work himself. And what Shelley does is unique, I think, within the field in that, so Shelley Wright's work is focused on near-infrared astronomy and instrumentation. So in the past several years, there has been an effort, I think, to broaden SETI from beyond the radio and then out into other wavelengths of light. And part of the motivation for that is that, you know, even here on Earth, we humans don't use radio waves to communicate nearly as much as we did at the beginning of SETI in the sort of middle of the last century. But we use all kinds of other forms of electromagnetic radiation or light to communicate with each other. So Dr. Wright works on something called NeuroSETI, which is the near infrared and optical search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And it's a special instrument that is designed to look for infrared signs of technologically advanced light. So this could be something like pulsed lasers, which sounds very like futuristic and science fictional, right? But if you think about it, you know, we human astronomers here on Earth actually use lasers all the time in the course of astronomical work. And, you know, we don't use them so much for communication, but they actually are a great way of communicating through the plane of the galaxy, because these particular wavelengths of light are less easily absorbed by the dust that is in between the stars. So really, Dr. Wright works on this extremely specialized forefront of an entirely untapped area of SETI research. And so, you know, as one of the people who is really pioneering that work, we thought that she would be a wonderful recipient for this year's Drake Award.
Well, Lucianne, thank you so much for talking to us about Dr. Shelley Wright.
Oh, my pleasure, and congratulations to Dr. Wright.
Let's talk now to the winner of the Frank Drake Award for SETI Science in 2022, University of California at San Diego astronomer Dr. Shelley Wright. Shelley, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me here today.
Well, I'd like to start by finding out about your area of expertise, where you really, you know, you do so many incredible things that we can talk about, but you're the shining star of optical SETI and a pioneer in that. But I think a lot of us don't really understand what optical SETI is. We know the search for extraterrestrial intelligence using traditional radio telescopes, like in the movie Contact. Maybe people have seen that. But what is optical SETI?
Great question. So radio is one form of light and a great way to communicate over long distances. But really, if you look at light and the entire electromagnetic spectrum, you know, you can look at different frequencies and do a carrier of information. And so this idea has been around for a long time. In fact, it was a Nobel Prize winner, Charles Townes, that speculated that optical SETI, sending interstellar messages, potentially even using lasers, for which Townes won a Nobel Prize for inventing, would be a fantastic way to communicate over large interstellar distances. A laser is directed, right? It's very bright, and you can pack a lot of information into it. And so this got scientists thinking on how would you detect or receive a laser-like signal? And if there was a transmitter, another civilization using a laser to communicate over hundreds or even thousands of light years, because lasers are so bright. And optical SETI was born. It was looking at making receivers or instruments that would be able to detect large optical beacons. Today, it doesn't have to be a laser, but that's just one method of thinking about transmitters. But it's just the idea that you can use other frequencies of light, not just radio, for communicating over long interstellar distances.
Ah, and how did you first get interested in optical SETI? When did this first catch your attention, where you decided this was an area you really wanted to pursue?
Well, it actually dates back to the late 90s when I was an undergraduate student at UC Santa Cruz, and I saw a flyer for the first astrobiology conference that was going to be at NASA Ames. And somewhere that just got me hyped about the idea of life in the universe and astrobiology, that I skipped school for a week and I went. And it was at that conference that I was sitting at a lunch and I met the pioneer Frank Drake and others in the field like Dan Wertheimer. And at that lunch, they were talking about building some of the first optical SETI detectors. And I was hooked and I never left. And so I've been involved with optical SETI now for over 20 years.
So you actually wound up academically advantaging yourself by cutting school for a week.
That's right.
That's pretty amazing. That's a pretty amazing story. Well, if you're going to cut school, you know, at least you're going to school in a different way. All right. I love that story. And tell me a bit about, you know, you mentioned Frank Drake. For those of our listeners who really don't know that much about him, tell us a bit about Frank Drake and, you know, for you personally, what it feels like to win an award with his name on it.
Well, Frank Drake is literally the father and the pioneer for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, especially beyond the scope of our own solar system. He did the first search using the Green Bank telescope for radio wavelengths in the field of SETI. And he also is famous for the Drake equation, which was trying to understand the probability of civilizations existing with us today in our own Milky Way and the likelihood of communication. And it's a fantastic way of thinking about life in the universe. And Frank was revolutionary, not just in SETI, but in astronomy over his career, both at Cornell and at UC Santa Cruz. And he really, you know, lit the field up for SETI, both nationally and internationally. To win the award named after him is an incredible honor. He's a fantastic scientist. And as I learned from, you know, my undergrad years, as he was one of my mentors, is he's an incredible human being.
Yeah, it's got to feel great to win an award like that when you have a personal connection to him too. That's wonderful.
It is a fantastic honor, and it is very special.
Well, tell us a bit about the state of the art now. What are some of the really interesting things and technologies that you're using in optical SETI?
So there's two ways to do a SETI search, you know, or And this is true at radio wavelengths. One way is to look at individual stars and look at many frequencies and see if there's a signal there. And that's a good method, but there are hundreds of billions of stars. So another method to look at SETI and the search for ET is to say we want to look at, you know, millions of stars. We want to look at large areas and swaths of the sky. And for optical SETI several decades ago, it was really the targeted search. We would kind of look at one star at a time. And what we've been thinking about in this next decade for optical SETI is how do you look at large areas of the sky and how do you do that all of the time? And so what our teams have been thinking about is how do you make an all sky, all time dedicated SETI observatory? And that's been an incredible joy to think about because the engineering challenge for building a facility that is able to look at thousands of square degrees and look all of the time with all of that data is actually a hard thing to do. And so it's made us look at clever ways of building new instruments.
And does it pose a problem with all of the satellite activity going on? We've been putting satellites in orbit since 1957, but really at an increasing rate recently with, you know, some of these communication satellites like Starlink, stuff like that. Is that causing a problem for the kind of work you do?
The answer is yes and no. Satellites are challenging. Starlink, the new satellites that Elon Musk is putting up, are quite bright. And that impacts not just SETI, it impacts a lot of observational astronomy. And they're trying to make satellites less bright for that reason. So yes, it is a noise source, so to speak, that we have to look at, but we've had to kind of develop our algorithms around them. And the good thing about satellites are, for the most part, you know exactly where they are, so you can weed them out of your data.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with astronomer Shelley Wright, the recipient of the 2022 Frank Drake Award from the SETI Institute. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with Dr. Shelley Wright. She's an astronomer from UC San Diego and the recipient of the 2022 Frank Drake Award from the SETI Institute. I also saw that you're involved with an instrument that I found very interesting to read about on the Keck telescope. It's called LIGER. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You have pronounced it correctly. It's LIGER, which is a hybrid animal named after a tiger and a lion.
That's what I was wondering. So, because I've heard of that kind of LIGER before. Tell us about that instrument because it looks really interesting.
So LIGER is an instrument that we are designing to build for the WM Keck Observatory. The Keck Observatory is the largest ground-based telescope, one of them, and one of the leading ones of the world. And it is taking interesting designs of looking at spectroscopy and imaging for a range of science cases. And this kind of gets back to my background. So I do a lot of instrumentation. I like to think about new ways to build cameras and spectrographs to look at the universe in unique ways. And that's my training. And that training got started through optical SETI, but it's been expanded to basically all of observational astronomy at optical wavelengths. The reason why it's called LIGER, you may be wondering that.
Yep.
We took this design and we adapted it between two different types of instruments. One is for the future 30-meter telescope project, which is called IRIS. And the other was to look at designs for the WM Keck Observatory. And so we are marrying two different instrument designs, one for the 30-meter telescope and one for Keck Observatory. And our team liked the idea of a hybrid animal. And so we got stuck on LIGER, which is the largest cat in the world. And it's a hybrid animal.
And of course, the Keck Observatory is atop Mauna Kea in Hawaii. And lately, there's been all kinds of interesting controversial stuff about building new instruments up there because of the concerns of the indigenous people of Hawaii and their traditions. What's the latest? What's going on there? Are things getting better, or how is it going with that?
Yeah, so Mauna Kea is one of the best mountaintop observatories in the world to do astronomy. And astronomy has been conducted up there since the 60s. And the state of Hawaii has had, you know, Hawaiian sovereignty and real issues for the Hawaiian community across all of the islands. And what struck up controversy or issues surrounding the astronomy of Mauna Kea was the potential of building the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea. And there were protests at the time once the 30-meter telescope was granted a permit to build. At that time, right now, there are no protests, I think, believe on site. And that project, the 30-meter telescope, I believe is working within the Hilo community in the Big Island, trying to figure out how we can do science respectfully and working with the indigenous community and the community of Hawaii itself. And so the current standing is a lot of discussions between scientists and engineers. And I mean, I don't live on Hawaii, I live in California, but working within the community to see how we can improve those relations.
Yes, well, the 30-meter telescope, that's truly a huge instrument.
It is a very large instrument. It's a 30-meter telescope is a future design where it would have 30 meters in diameter.
Wow.
And the way I like to think about that is it's a Major League Baseball diamond. So is that,
wow,
that's a lot of glass. It actually has 496 segments that gets phased into a parabola for an incredibly large collecting area.
Oh my. Well, let's talk a bit more about some of your SETI work. Give me a sense of where you think the state of SETI is right now, compared to when you started. What is the state of the science? Because it's gone through some interesting times, of periods when it was disrespected by some people, and then found respect with others. There's been kind of an evolution because of NASA's search for life beyond Earth, that SETI has kind of become, I think, more mainstream to some scientists. I've always found it to be a fascinating field. And what to me, it's one of those things where, you know, you have to do the experiment, you have to do the search, or, you know, how would you know? How can you answer the question if you don't look? What do you think about the state of the science of SETI right now?
That's a great question. And there's so much packed into it. You know, when I was an undergrad, when I was leaving to go on to my career in graduate studies, they told me, you know, the advice I got from all my mentors was, you can't go into SETI, you need to go into traditional, you know, quote, traditional astronomy. And that's what I did. So that's how I got involved with a large ground-based telescope instrumentation. It was taboo. So it was taboo to do SETI.
Kind of sounds like a scene right out of Contact, where the Ellie Arroway character is basically told, you know, you shouldn't be doing this stuff.
Yeah, what's surprising about it was that it was taboo within the science community, right? So it was not necessarily the broader community. It was almost inverse. If you go anywhere in the world, I think if you tell someone you're an astronomer, they think, oh, you're looking for ET, you're looking for other life.
Sure.
And the truth is, there's not many scientists that do that. That's probably the illuminating thing as a young scientist back then. How it's changed is today, I think, in science, not completely, but in the field of astronomy and astrophysics, it's becoming more accepted. And another example I would give, you know, personally on this is that, you know, as I've gone through my career, most of my SETI research, even though I did it as a hobby or did it in the background, wasn't on my primary CV for that reason, or my resume, because people are so triggered by that topic. So, you know, thankfully, and I think it's because we can say now that Earth is not rare, the fact that, you know, most, if not all stars have planets around them, terrestrial planets, you know, planets the size of Earth are very, very common. 1 in 5 stars, like our sun, has an Earth-sized planet, which was one of the pre-arguments for, you know, maybe life being rare in the universe was in fact, maybe planets were rare. But I think that that changed the scientific community's mind. And then, as you've mentioned, NASA astrobiology portfolio was, you know, all about trying to find life, but they meant microbial life, not not life driving around, you know, in cars or spaceships and shooting lasers, so to speak. And so there was a real disconnect there. I think, you know, I'm happy to say in my lab and my, the work I do, I work with undergraduates and graduate students, and I'm happy to see that that climate has changed, but not fully. I think we still have work to do.
Well, you mentioned the exoplanets, and we talked to, for another segment of this program, we talked to Jesse Christensen, the archivist for NASA's exoplanets, and we're at 5,000 exoplanets now. So could you maybe talk a bit about how that number of exoplanets we know of now, and you kind of touched on it there, but how important is that, you know, to directing how you go about SETI now?
It's incredibly important. So now we understand the statistics that planets are common, and that 5,000 number, you know, those are exoplanets around stars that are near us within our kind of solar community. But that 5,000 number is important because it will now be able to tell us characteristics of the planets, like how many planets may have oceans. In the coming decade, you know, what will be the atmospheres of those planets? And so we're going to start doing, you know, kind of exoplanetary geology and exoplanetary atmospheres. And that becomes incredibly important for understanding habitability. So if you have planetary services, how likely is it microbial life would exist? And then how likely does that planet lay in the habitable zone? Is it millions of years, billions of years? Does it allow time for evolution into more advanced species? And so us characterizing exoplanets and understanding that those statistics is critical for our understanding of the likelihood of life, and especially intelligent life within our galaxy.
Yes, it's an extremely exciting time for astronomy in general, because there's so many things going on with, you know, gravitational wave experiments and all these things. You also do other types of astronomy. What are some of your other research interests?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I love to study supermassive black holes.
Well, who doesn't? they're fascinating.
So my other area of study is using these large telescopes to study distant galaxies and their supermassive black holes. So an interesting fact that astronomers have learned in the last few decades is that most, if not all, galaxies at its center lurks a gigantic supermassive black hole. So for instance, within our own Milky Way galaxy, at the center of it, there's a 4 million mass black hole, the mass of the sun, 4 million times the mass of the sun at its center. And of course, that discovery just won the Nobel Prize with Andrea Ghez and Reinhard Genzel. And so what's interesting about supermassive black holes is, how does the supermassive black hole know about the galaxy and the galaxy knows about the supermassive black holes? It turns out that bigger galaxies have bigger supermassive black holes and smaller galaxies have smaller supermassive black holes. And one of the things we're trying to figure out is why. And so gravity is actually a pretty weak force. And so the fact that that is correlated and they know about each other implies some interesting astrophysics. And so my team, we look at distant, some of the first supermassive black holes that turn on after the Big Bang. We're talking 10 billion light years away, and understand how the galaxy itself forms around them.
Will this be something that the James Webb Space Telescope would be particularly suited to study?
James Webb Space Telescope, for which I think we're all very excited to turn on this summer and get some of those first images, this will be a primary area of study. One of the leading science cases for James Webb is to look at the first galaxies and the first stars that turn on after the Big Bang, and how even seeds of black holes form. And then how do you get smaller black holes? Do they merge to make larger black holes, and then how do you even get a behemoth, like a supermassive black hole? And that's one of the leading science cases. And James Webb is big enough to and sensitive enough to detect these distant objects.
Is there, do you think, and I'm, this may be completely off base, but is there a relationship between the type of supermassive black hole that you find in a galaxy and the galactic structure, like the type of galaxy it is, whether it's like a spiral or a barred spiral or, you know, something irregular or elliptical?
There is a relationship that really points to the mass. So elliptical galaxies are, you know, kind of these football, or I like to call them rugby-shaped galaxies.
They look like blimps.
Yeah, they look like blimps. And they're the most massive galaxies. So they have, you know, more mass within it, larger than the Milky Way. And for those, they have galaxies, those galaxies have supermassive black holes that are 10 billion times the mass of the sun. Whereas again, our Milky Way has 4 million times the mass sun. So elliptical galaxies typically have supermassive black holes that are a billion times the mass of the sun. And then our ordinary kind of spiral galaxies have millions of times the mass of the sun. And it goes smaller. So we're interested in things called intermediate mass black holes. So how do you get things that are maybe, do are there 1,000 solar mass supermassive black holes? And that is still lurking. We don't know yet.
One of the most interesting things to me about supermassive black holes is to see what's going on around them in the center of those galaxies, because the stars orbiting them are going at just tremendous velocities. Could you tell us a bit about that?
So sometimes supermassive black holes are just hanging out and kind of sipping at material. And sometimes they're not. Sometimes they are accreting a large masses of material. And that's typically in something called an accretion disk. And the accretion disk, because it's rotating so fast, thousands of kilometers per second, orbiting the supermassive black hole, heats up and releases a ton of energy. And you can even flare. So large brightnesses of sources from it. And those are typically called active galactic nuclei. And some of the brightest sources in the universe are called quasars. And it's that interaction, that that luminosity, that energy that comes from that accretion disk that may influence the larger galaxy as a whole. Alluding back to that question I had about how does the galaxy know about the supermassive black hole, and how does the supermassive black hole know about the galaxy?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you have two areas of research, at least, that are among the most interesting topics in astronomy and astrophysics.
Yes, life in the universe and black holes.
Wow. Wow, doesn't get you, you do the greatest hits. Okay, so before we let you go, back to SETI, since you did win the Frank Drake Award, I was listening to an interview with Brian Cox the other day, and he was sounding kind of pessimistic about, you know, hey, it's really possible that, you know, the Earth is it in the Milky Way, that there's no other place where there's life or advanced forms of life anyway. And of course, there's the famous Fermi paradox that says, you know, if there's all this alien civilizations and life out there, you know, why haven't they shown up? Why haven't we observed them yet? What is your answer to those kinds of points of view?
Well, first off, we don't know. The number one factor here is the lifetime of a civilization. So I think you can arguably say that if there are many planetary surfaces and there's a lot of habitable zones, that, you know, hopefully life is inevitable. The question is, you know, does life develop into an intelligent form? Does it develop civilization? Does it develop technology? And if it does, how long does it survive?
Does it survive it?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So to coexist with, you know, another species with technology depends on how long we're here. And the truth is, for humans, we've only had technology for a very brief period of Earth's history, and of course, you know, humankind's history. So that remains to be seen. But if we ever made a discovery of another intelligent civilization, you would expect it to be thousands of years, you know, tens of thousands of years ahead of us.
Well, and at the same time, conversely, it's probably going to be fairly far away, so they will also be in the past.
Yeah, it's a very slow pen pal communication. That is definitely true.
So if they're a couple hundred light years away, which is relatively close in the galaxy, you know, we're checking them out as they were 200 years ago.
That's right. And the galaxy, right, the size of our Milky Way is 100,000 light years.
Oh, yeah.
With, you know, close to 350 billion stars. So it is challenging to presume that, you know, or to know whether we are existing now with nobody else in such a large vast.
Well, I've always liked Jill Tarter's take on it, where she says it's like, okay, you go out to the beach and go to the ocean and dip a big glass into the ocean and look at it, and you don't see any fish or octopi or whales or anything in that glass of water. So, guess there's no life in the ocean.
It's a perfect way to describe it, because it also points to the fact that we've barely searched and that we have so much more work to do in the field of SETI.
Okay, before we let you go, what's the future look like? What are some interesting future projects for you in particular and, you know, SETI in general?
So I think the future is looking really bright for SETI, for optical SETI and radio SETI. There are a number of new programs coming online. For our program and our team, we're excited in two areas. One of the things we've been working on is trying to extend optical SETI into infrared SETI, and building experiments that don't just detect optical light, which is like the visible light, like our eye can see, but also look at near infrared and infrared wavelengths, longer wavelengths than for which the eye can look at. And these are new experiments that we're putting on now in the last 5 years, and we're looking to put on in the future to explore different wavelengths of communication. The second area touches upon this all sky, all time. And we're looking at building a new facility called Panoramic SETI, which is a dedicated observatory where we'll do tens and twenties of telescopes to try to instantaneously take a picture of the night sky over 4,000 square degrees. And we try to do this at different time resolutions. So we'll take a picture of the night sky every nanosecond, a billionth of a second, over 4,000 square degrees instantaneously. And what we're looking for is instantaneous flashes or anything that looks artificial. And we can do that at nanoseconds or microseconds, which is 1/1,000,000th of a second. And we're looking at very bright flashes that would be unusual and that are repeat even potentially. And that's never really been done before. And this is going to be coming online in the next few years. It's interesting for SETI, but anytime we look at nature in a new way, we may discover something new that nature produces at that time resolution.
Yeah, that's one of the other things great about doing SETI is you're also collecting all kinds of interesting information about the galaxy and nature.
One of the things I enjoy about being a SETI researcher so much is that we are able to look at the universe in different ways than we do in any other astronomy field. And I think that has exciting promise to making new discoveries about our universe.
Well, Dr. Shelley Wright, winner of the 2022 Frank Drake Award from the SETI Institute, it's been a joy to talk to you. Congratulations again, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to our guest, astrophysicist Shelley Wright, winner of the SETI Institute's prestigious Frank Drake Award in 2022. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, producer Matt Fidler and I will discuss the upcoming culmination of our Apollo at 50 series and the new Netflix movie, Apollo 10 and a Half. And we're back. I am joined now by the maestro himself, our producer, Matt Fidler. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm great.
So it's the last, just a couple of weeks ago, we finished off the Apollo 16 show, 50th anniversary, of course. And that means we only have one more. There's only one more Apollo mission. And it's kind of making me a little, you know, reminiscent about what it must have been to be alive during that time. Of course, that all happened almost 10 years before I was born. But you were a child growing up during the Apollo missions. That must have had quite an effect on you, an impression.
Yes. Certainly. You know, I was 9 years old when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, 8 when Apollo 8 went to the moon. And for me, you know, watching these flights was like, for kids now, you know, if you're really into sports and you're watching the Super Bowl or the NBA playoffs or, you know, the World Series or whatever floats your boat, that was the big thing. And so it was wall-to-wall TV coverage. We all, you know, watched these incredible flights to the moon. And it was, you know, it was a simpler time in terms of media because you really had three networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, covering these missions. And it was like from liftoff to splashdown, it was a big deal. And it was plastered all over television. It was something that was kind of universally experienced by Americans and people around the world.
Has doing these 50th anniversaries of these missions, has this brought back some of these feelings and memories from your childhood?
Oh, yes. Yes, it has. It's been interesting because each mission has, you know, brought back specific memories to me. And our most recent one with Apollo 16, you know, made me think about Charlie Duke, Brigadier General Duke, and it made me remember his, you know, when we were talking to him, his famous line when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon and said, you know, Roger Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. It was Charlie who answered Neil, and he was, you know, everybody was so stressed out and nervous that he could barely get the words out. He said, Roger Tranquility, he said Tranquility, couldn't even get Tranquility out. He said, you know, you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue here because they've been holding their breaths. And thanks a lot. And that was Charlie. You know, Charlie was the first person that Neil Armstrong heard from Earth, you know, in his headset and Buzz Aldrin. So that brought up that memory really vividly. And so in each mission has had that for me, just bringing back these childhood memories. And it's so interesting, you know, when you consider, when you're my age, it's just like 62, you know, memory's an interesting thing. You know, we remember things and you wonder how accurate they are and, you know, how much of this is real and are just impressions and, you know, what does it all mean? It's really fascinating. One of the great things for me has been reliving all this through, you know, the history of these programs we're doing.
Well, speaking of memories and trying to, things that may or may not have existed, can you tell me about the mission of Apollo 10 and a half?
Yeah, Apollo 10 and a half is not a real mission. It's a film. It's a film on Netflix right now.
I saw that on Netflix, but I haven't clicked on it.
You haven't watched it yet, right?
You would have to watch it. I haven't watched it yet, but...
Well, I was under the impression that I wasn't going to. It just looked kind of silly to me. You know, there's no Apollo 10 and a half. But I started to watch it, and then all of a sudden I had this revelation that this is a wonderful film. You know, it's made by a great filmmaker, Richard Linklater. He made like Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Boyhood, has Milo Coy as the boy playing the main character. His name is Stan, and he's like, you know, my age back then. And Jack Black is the narrator as Stan is, you know, like my age now. So it was just fascinating. And the opening of the film is what just really drew me in. Immediately, I knew I was probably going to like this.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff.
As it opens up at Ed White Elementary School in El Lago, Texas. And that El Lago is one of those neighborhoods that sprouted up around the manned, what it was called, the Manned Spacecraft Center back then, now Johnson Space Center, in Houston. those little neighborhoods sprung up all around it to give places for people who work there to live.
The time is spring 1969. The place is Ed White Elementary School in El Lago, Texas, a southeastern suburb right down the road from NASA. The occasion on this fateful day that put everything in motion, fourth grade recess.
And that's where the Apollo astronauts would live in these neighborhoods, alongside with flight controllers and flight directors like our friend Jerry Griffin and all of their children, and people who worked for NASA in all kinds of ways, like the main character's dad, who's he's a supply guy working for NASA. So that opening at the elementary school really sucked me in.
So Ed White Elementary School, is this a real place?
Oh, yes. And Ed White was one of the great astronauts of that time. He died tragically in the Apollo 1 fire in 1967, which we have, you know, if as we've gone along through all of these Apollo missions, Apollo 1 is always there in the background as this terrible tragedy that if they hadn't figured out what went wrong with Apollo 1 and why it burned to a crisp and incinerated those astronauts, they never would have made it to the moon. And Ed White was one of the most athletic of all the astronauts, just an incredible guy. And he was the first American to have an extravehicular activity, walk in space. There was even a popular song about him, about Ed White's spacewalk back in the 60s. And he died. And they named the elementary school after him, I think, before he passed away. And then it became even more profound afterwards. And these children, you know, they're going to Ed White Elementary School. You know, Ed used to live there, you know, in that neighborhood with his family.
Wow. Well, when I was looking at the little advertisement for the movie on Netflix, it looked like it was animated. Is this a cartoon?
Well, it yes, and Richard Linklater has used this animation style before in some of his earlier films. It's called rotoscope, and basically what you're doing, it's pretty advanced, but basically you're filming live action, live actors, you know, real people, and then you have this animation overlay on it, which in this film makes it look hyper realistic in a way, and yet like it almost looks like Kodachrome old photographs from the 1960s that gives it this retro feel. One of the funniest parts is they show young Stan, you know, like any kid, like I did, we watched cartoons. And there's even animated overlay of the cartoons, you know, the Bugs Bunny cartoons and things like that, which is kind of like, okay, you got an animation overlay of an animation. That's pretty hilarious.
You think this was kind of a stylistic choice to maybe admit that these are kind of based on real events, but this is a fiction story?
Yes, well, and I think it's also trying to convey that this is memory. And, you know, memory is an elusive thing. This is a child, these are his childhood memories growing up in the 60s. And I feel the same way, like, what are the specific things I really remember? And what are things that I think I remember? In some of the scenes, like on the playground in elementary school and the games they played, television shows they watched, you know, Gilligan's Island and, you know, all those famous old 60s sitcoms. Then, you know, he and his family are all watching the same things that I watched. And it made me realize how universal our experience was back in the 1960s because, you know, no matter where you lived, I lived in Los Angeles, but the Apollo program was a huge backdrop of LA too, because that's where the command module was built in Southern California. That's where the big rocket engines were tested not far from my home in the San Fernando Valley. We could see them being tested at night sometimes. So in a big way, it was like, I think back on it, it's like, yeah, my life was intertwined with NASA, even though nobody in my family was. It was all around me, even in Los Angeles. But we watched the same kinds of TV shows and the scary movies on Friday nights and all of the products and everything. It's just so perfectly well done that it's a memory trigger after memory trigger.
Wow. Okay, well, I need to know, why is it called Apollo 10 and a half? What's the significance of that? Because obviously, yeah, Apollo 11 was the one that everyone is very familiar with, the first landing on the moon. But why is it called 10 and a half?
Well, because it's between Apollo 10 and Apollo 11. And it's supposedly, here's the storyline, is NASA goofed and they made the lunar module a little too small for adults. So they had to send a kid first before Neil went there. And so this character, Stan, gets recruited right off the kickball field there at the elementary school by two NASA guys that come in. They're kind of secret agent-y people. They tell him, we got this top secret mission for you, and you're going to fly to the moon, and we're going to use a cover that you're going to summer camp. And they've got all these pictures of him at summer camp to prove that, you know, they've got it all covered. And so they send him to the moon, and so he experiences all of these things, the same things that the Apollo astronauts do.
Yeah, yeah, laugh all you want. But here's what they told me.
Good job, Stan. You didn't pass out. Hey, don't worry about the vomit. Every astronaut, from John Glenn to Neil Armstrong, they all up chuck. At least the first time.
Now, the thing is, like, is this real? No, this is this child's fantasy, which all of us had. You know, all of us wanted to be Neil Armstrong. All of us wanted to, you know, oh, I want to be an astronaut and go walk on the moon. Wouldn't that be cool? But he's like going so deeply into these memories that he fantasizes about, you know, where it becomes real, a real story. So it's an interesting storytelling trick that he uses. So is the young man Stan actually go to the moon? No. In fact, when he's watching the moon landing, spoiler alert, he falls asleep on the couch, and his mom even says something like, well, he'll think he saw it later on in life. You know, he'll know that he was here, and he sleeps through it because he's tired from, they send the kids off to a little place called Astro World where they spend the day getting worn out on rides and stuff like that. It's kind of like a little astro-themed Disneyland kind of place, the amusement park.
They were going to land on the moon sometime in the afternoon and walk on it in the evening. But Dad had a surprise option for us.
Okay, we've been given some discounted tickets to Astro World, but they're only good for today. So, you can go, obviously, or you can stay here with us and watch the news coverage of the moon landing.
Astro World!
But won't we miss the landing?
No, sweetie, they're not scheduled to walk until later today, so you'll be home for that.
He's so worn out from it all when he gets home, he sleeps through the moon landing. And while his dad is enthralled because he works for NASA and he's proud of the part he's played, even though it's, you know, he's a guy who orders supplies for offices at Houston.
Wow.
So, you know, I think for anybody who grew up in the 1960s, this film will really resonate with you and bring back a lot of memories, and it'll be fun. And for people who are not, it will show you really what being a child was like back then and how the Apollo program was really in the backdrop of all of our lives. It was a big part. And anybody who grew up then, you know, you remember where you were on July 20th, 1969, even if it was on the couch falling asleep with your mom's arm around you. So, yeah, Matt, let me just ask you a quick question. What's been the most fun aspect for you doing producing all of these Apollo programs?
Well, yeah, I mean, I covered some of these subjects growing up in school, but to hear the specifics of the missions and to learn about all the problems that they had to overcome on every single mission, there was something out of the ordinary that came up and people and these brilliant minds had to solve these things to make something happen. And every mission, it wasn't just Apollo 13 that had troubles. It was every mission. And so that's been really fascinating to hear about all these technical issues that they learned and built off of from previous missions. It's just been very impressive. The other thing is just more of a personal thing. It was amazing to get to talk to these astronauts and engineers that were doing these amazing things. And that's because of you. So thanks, Dave.
No, you're welcome. And you've done such a great job of producing these programs. It's going to be sad to see it coming to an end with Apollo 17 in December.
I know.
It was the final mission to the moon and the only one that had a real scientist on it, Harrison Schmitt. So we will definitely close it out with a big bang as we close out our Apollo at 50 series.
Well, I look forward to those interviews and hearing all the nuance and details of the final Apollo mission.
Yeah, the last human on the moon, the last man is also is as compelling as the first.
Indeed. And thank you for telling me about the movie Apollo 10 and a half. I'm going to have to go watch that.
It's a lot of fun. It's not, you know, it's it, what's nice about it. There's nothing, you could watch it with any family member and there's nothing like really bad in it or, you know, it's not.
It's a nice family film.
It's a family film and it's nothing earth shattering. It's just a lot of fun.
Well, it sounds like it did a good job of creating the vibe that you experienced as a kid.
It does. And at the same time, it also keeps it real. It also shows a lot of, you know, there's the peripheral stuff, the Vietnam War, racial unrest, riots in the cities, those things that are the child is seeing on television that are part of this background of his life. But, you know, they almost seem like his dream mission. They almost seem not real to him.
Very cool.
Thanks again to our guests, Lucianne Wolkowitz from the Adler Planetarium in Chicago and University of California, San Diego, astrophysics professor Shelley Wright, the winner of the prestigious Frank Drake Award in 2022 from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, for her pioneering work in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. You can find out more about Dr. Wright and all of the research being done at the SETI Institute at SETI.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that at our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow our show on Twitter and Instagram at blue.nspr. Our social media coordinator is Angela Osterello. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.